Estonia had a long history of social experiments gone awry. The reformers are only going to have one shot at this. They can't possibly have a prolonged, like, oh, we have to sacrifice today in order to have benefits in the future, because they've already heard that. And so they had to move as quickly as they could to economic freedom.
Socialism podcast, where we're trying to understand more about what life was like in socialist societies and how they started down towards their path towards socialism and what factors helped them turn away from socialism. I'm joined once again by Dr. Peter Betke, who is a distinguished university professor of economics and philosophy at George Mason University, as well as the director of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center. Pete, thank you again for taking time to talk with us about Estonia. I'm excited to continue this conversation. I learned a lot about Estonia's history and what life was like under socialism there and some of the problems that kind of plague an economy that is under central planning. In this episode, I really want to talk a little bit more about some of the lessons and the takeaways we can walk away from with Estonia's story. They've spent more than 50 years under socialism, and now we're kind of 30 years after that fact, and they're 12th in the world today in terms of economic freedom. So that's just an amazing rebound. What can we walk away from with this story?
So I think I would like to stress, going back to our conversation about the Singing Revolution, that prior to the Singing Revolution and Mart Lahr and another fellow dissident in 1987 formed the Estonian National Historical Association, which was to try to communicate and what about the long history of Estonia to counter the Soviet narrative about everything. And that and also to challenge, again, as I said, the annexation of the Baltic states due to the pact between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. One of the things that we do in the book is we quote Orwell twice. So we quote him in Animal Farm, in which, the animals are looking at the pig, they're looking at man, they're looking at the pig, they're looking at man, and they can't tell the difference between the two of those. That was the analogy of looking at communism, fascism, and you can't tell the difference between the two of them. And that's kind of, the experience that they had and that was thrust upon them. And then the second thing is at the very end, Orwell's claim in 1984 that he who controls the past controls the future, right, or controls the present, and who controls the present controls the past. And this is about why, history matters so much and whatnot. And I think this is really an important thing. So the first thing I want to stress is that, and we detail a lot, is that this was an oppressive totalitarian system, all right, in which you had deportations of its citizens because they're trying to control them. They're Adam Smith's man of systems with the people as pawns on their chessboard. And when the pawns decide to act on their own, the only thing you can do is either eliminate them, right? So you deport them or you actually murder them. And so this is a regime in which people are sent off to camps to die, labor camps and everything like that. This is an oppressive regime. The transition then, when you want to transition away from this oppressive regime, it's more than just economics. It's economics, it's legal, it's political, it's social, it's psychological. These all have to, be brought into the play in the transition. And so one way that we think about the transition is people will say things like, you just have to rip the Band-Aid off. So you would kind of think of the just do it as rip the Band-Aid off.
Right.
Balcerowicz, for example, in Poland, what he said, his direct quote is, bitter medicine is easier to take in one dose than over prolonged doses. So we have to do that. But I think Estonia is a slightly different case. All right. It's a slightly different case than just rip the Band-Aid off. What it is that Estonia had a long history of social experiments gone awry. So like what you were saying before about going back and then this way and that way. And so the reformers are only going to have one shot at this. They can't possibly have a prolonged, like, oh, we have to sacrifice today in order to have benefits in the future, because they've already heard that so many times. So it's completely not only not credible, but simply not, desirable, right? I mean, they're not going to find it to be a compelling kind of thing. So they had to figure out, as Andres Ashland puts it, you know, what you're supposed to do when nearly everything works poorly, the state is extremely weak, and the resistance of the new class or the old ruling elite is going to be very strong because they want to hold on to their bennies, right?
Right.
So how is it that you are going to transition? So much of this economic, legal, political, social, and psychological transition requires that you move quickly and decisively at one time, because that's the only way that you're going to have coherence. If you try to phase it in, what you're going to do is you're going to end up by having like all kinds of disjoints in the process and incoherence. And so they had to move as quickly as they could to economic freedom. They had to move. And this is why you get a flat tax. This is, you know, all these other kinds of things. And one of the things that was fascinating about their story is that a lot of other countries at the time in the early 2000s that would have benefited by joining the European Union. Right. So there's policy harmony in the European Union. And by them joining, this was Václav Klaus's justification in the Czech Republic. By us joining, we became more economically free than we could have on our own because of the resistance in our own country to transition. So by joining, we actually get more economic freedom than we otherwise would have. Okay. On the other hand, Estonia, by joining, would have got less economic freedom. And so I think we should remember that aspect of how much and how fast they went as the foundation for any kind of conversation that we have here. Now, back up a minute. And again, you know, the basic policy consensus that's even in any of the shock therapy kind of discussions is some form or another of the Washington consensus.
Right.
And so we have to remember the components of that Washington consensus, its relationship to your own components of economic freedom, and then whether or not you have sequencing, right, or whether you have shock therapy. So you either have gradualism or you have it in one fell swoop. But that's a lot more complicated than just rip the Band-Aid off.
Right.
And I just wanted to get that out on the table.
Yeah, because the various countries had different levels of success with the Washington consensus. And that was kind of one of, I think, Andre Schleifer's criticisms with the helping hand and the grabbing hand type of conversation. So
but the question is why did they have, right? So if you're going to explain, so like to me, I think economics as a framework, and this is as an intellectual frame. So, you know, basically my own view is that economics, you're a great teacher of economics. So
relevant.
I think you'll probably resonate relevant with what I'm about to say. But I think that what we do when we teach economics to young people is we should first and foremost
relevant
teach economics as a tool for the curious.
Relevant.
So it's not actual results. It's a right way of thinking. And then they can use it and see the world, right? And then, you know, and then it's a discipline so that they can have effective compassion. Not that they don't have compassion. We want them to have compassion and be concerned and are like that. The question is, what are the policies that actually can actually do good in the world rather than make it sound like I'm doing good in the world, right? So we're a tool for
the curious
and a discipline for the compassion. But what is that tool, right? And the way I would say it is, We don't want to use preference-based explanations. Precisely because, not that preference-based explanations don't explain things. They just don't need a theory to explain it.
Right.
You know, lots of people go to a Taylor Swift concert because they like Taylor Swift. Okay, right? That doesn't require an advanced theory. You know, good people doing good things, bad people doing bad things. There's no theory that. I knew that already in kindergarten. What's the theory? Stay away from bad people, right? Hang out only with good kids, right? But where economics comes in is when there's a disjoint. So saying I drink coffee because I like coffee, that doesn't tell me anything. But if it says I really like coffee, but I'm choosing to drink tea because the relative price of coffee, you know, and the relative price of tea has shifted such that my consumption pattern switches. Now I'm like, oh wow, I have to explain that, right? And that's how our curiosity is piqued, not by the tautologies, good people do good things, bad people do bad things.
Right.
Where we find disjointedness, discomfort, intellectual discomfort, right? And so individuals pursuing their self-interest, but they generate a publicly desirable outcome. How did that happen, right?
Right.
And so the way we explain that, or the opposite, which is individuals just want to pursue the best and they produce hell on earth. You know, how's that happen, right? And the way we do that is we freeze people and we're going to explain the variation in outcomes by the variation in institutions.
Right.
But the institutional details matter so much.
Right.
And so when we say that different peoples had different outcomes from the Washington Consensus, we often think, oh, the Washington Consensus is frozen and the people are what's shifting. And that explains the outcomes. And I'm like, no, not quite right. What's going on is that the people are people. So they're striving to do the best that they can given their situation. But the way in which the policies were implemented caused the problem. And that's where we diagnose, you know, did they actually solve the credible commitment problem? Did they have, you know, an issue in which they solved the transitional gains trap? Did they solve the transitional gain trap in a way that fits with the credible commitment, you know, and all of these other things? And so that's where I think, so you just can't say, you know, shock therapy and hang up the phone.
Right.
You actually have to dig into the details, and those details are going to be country specific.
Right.
Because it's in those countries where those things fit. And so that's, so I'm sorry for being long-winded, but
no, that's a really important point.
Yeah.
Right. And even countries that seem to have very similar histories have institutional details that are distinct in important ways. And so I think kind of going back to your discussion of culture in the book, right, that's one example where, you know, an institutional detail is very different in one place versus the next in a way that will matter, that will shape the credibility of the institutions and will shape our choices.
Yeah, you know, there's the old, you know, Tolstoy quip, right? That all families are miserable. They're just all miserable in their own way. I think, you know, it's something like the way in which we have to think about this. And I'll use one more economic methodology thing. You know, I know I'm removed from the content here, but I like to think of economic methodology in the following way, is that there's laws of economics which are similar to the laws of gravity or the laws of the tides. But then let's take the law of the tides. So the law of the tides is actually a universal law. It doesn't, you know, but the manifestation of the law of tides in any particular harbor is a function in which the harbor is constructed. And I think of the harbor as our institutions, right? And so when I say private property rights, property, contract, and consent, I have to give more content to that. Because if I just say property rights, well, how about in a world where those property rights are, you know, not fully defined or not fully enforced? So they're attenuated rights. How about property rights where I say you have cash flow rights, but you don't have control rights, all right? Or you have control rights, but not cash flow rights. What are you going to do, right, in those situations? So, like, it's a misnomer to say someone had real public ownership because someone was a decision maker. They just had control rights, but didn't have the cash flow rights, which meant that they had their own set of incentives and information they were working with. And so we have to get all devil in the details which economists don't want to do because they want to, that requires dirty empirical work. It requires actually digging in the dirt rather than the idea of, you know, of putting things in a regression at, you know, it's just some clean variable that I run. Okay, cool. I get it. Why I want to do that and everything, but you got to dig in the dirt. We got to be more like, as the way Lynn Ostrom put it, you know, more like biologists out in the wild, you know, that are looking around and trying to study life. So.
Yes. I think the field work as a complement to some of the bird's eye view, it is so important to really understanding what happened.
If your audience has some students that are PhD students in economics, one of the best articles they could ever read is by Lynn Ostrom. And it's an article that's in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. And I'm probably going to get the title wrong, but it's about forestry. And what she does is it's something like, you know, on the ground, from the air, in the lab. And what she talks about is multiple methods methodology. So she wants to study the pattern of forestry management. And so what she does is she first looks from satellite imagery, you know, to see actually what does it look like, what's going on in the forest, you know. And then what she does is she goes down into the field and she does like her normal field work. Then what she does is out of that, she figures out the game that they're playing and the pattern of resource use that they're going. And then she test beds it in a lab to see, you know, what kind of game the people play and, you know, in like a field experiment kind of thing. And so she does all three of those because she says any one of them doesn't quite give me the full picture. And I think if more economists bought that idea, then we would be a lot more empirical, right? We would be more a more empirically grounded discipline rather than the idea that there's one method and one method that rules it all.
Right. I think that's so important. And I agree with you. I think economics would be a much better space if people were open to mixed methodology.
We'd also have different people.
Pardon?
We'd also have different people that would bring different voice.
Right.
Because different people have different predilections about what kind of research they want to do. Right. And so there's a reason why anthropologists look the way that they do. There's a reason why, you know, sociologists look the way that they do, right? Historians look the way they do, why economists look the way they do. Right. And so if we opened ourselves up to an economic space that had this broader idea that we allowed anthrovision, right? That's a book by Gillian Gett, Anthrovision, which is, you know, kind of like a Freakonomics, but for anthropologists kind of ideas. If we opened ourselves up to that kind of space, how much more rich could our conversation be? I think it's amazing.
So let's think about how we can kind of tie that to Estonia's experience. What do you think economists, like the average economist, would miss in trying to explain what happened in Estonia?
Well, I think that a large part, so Estonia is one of those places that suffers in the large scale kind of econometrics questions when you pick a country, why should I care about this small country, right? They tend to think that's an N equals one, which is a very small one. Whereas I might actually say, if I'm going to do a case study on India, India. Right. China, you know, I can understand, you know, what I'm doing there. And so the issue, I think, is first, why from this very small like country, this slice in the world, can we actually learn so much about how you might be able to pull off reforms? Why are the particulars of Estonia more generalizable? Why can they scale and sustain in a way from the case? And I think that is one of the things that, you know, would be a challenge. And so it's important, I think, that the way you're doing the realities of socialism is a collection of case studies, because now the reader can get from the collection knowledge that otherwise they might doubt about the particulars of the external validity outside of N equals one. And so like in our studies that Matt and I did, you know, we try to do comparative. So we're always doing comparative studies, you know, where we're comparing them to either, you know, what we consider their basically, you know, not, we don't do this, but it's the same exercise that people do when they think about synthetic controls. We're right. trying to pick like who might be the synthetic Estonia, and then we want to compare the real Estonia with that, or right. the real Poland with that. Like, what could possibly have been the possibilities for Poland, and then compare it with that, and that's what we kind of try to find the right, you know, control group and all of that stuff. And so we think in those same terms that other more empirically minded economists do, but we're more focused on telling the story and giving life to the individuals within the story. Because as I said earlier, one of the things that I think that we learn in transition is the importance of pivotal people at pivotal times.
Right.
And this role, and we know that in the economy that entrepreneurship matters. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, an Eleanor Ostrom idea that public entrepreneurship matters. Because it's public entrepreneurs that are the rule changers, right?
Right.
They're the ones. And so we have to give them voice and give them space in our explanations. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes we don't do that in our economics. Not always, but certainly not in our journal articles.
Right. And so you mentioned Lahr as one of those pivotal people. Are there other pivotal key, maybe social entrepreneurs or political entrepreneurs that spring up in the Estonian story?
Well, I think that his partners, right? So, you know, I'm going to get the names wrong unless I look it up here.
No.
And, you know, he has various allies, of course, throughout the entire process that he works with, not just him, right? He's just one of many different, you know, sort of reformers. It also goes all the way back to the history of, you know, Estonia, like early on, like what does it mean to be an independent Estonia? There were thinkers and actors, you know, all the way back in their history that were pivotal characters that they could pin, you know, the people could pin their hopes on with that. And so, there's a conglomeration of actors that I think are very valuable people and brave souls. It's kind of, you know, like asking the question about, you know, was Gorbachev, you know, so pivotal? What about after him and everything like that? I will tell you that, you know, there's a lot of, if you use the Soviet case, you know, there's also pivotal actors that, you know, left the stage prematurely, and that might have been a different history. And it's a very risky business to do counterfactual history, you know, but at the same time, it's often unavoidable at some level too.
Yeah.
Right.
I know that's not I didn't give you any details, but just, you know, there's the, like, for example, when Lahr started the Estonian Historical or Heritage Association, you know, he did that with, that was along with a partner. It wasn't just himself doing it.
I mean, it's really hard to have that level of social change acting alone, right? Definitely need a massive network of people that are on board and supporting what you're doing.
Well, there's that, and a tipping point that happens, which is that your idea resonates enough. It's at the right time. And, you know, there's a great passage in Mill in a 1948 essay called The Claims of Labor. And he says something along the following. He says, ideas, unless circumstances are right, will just sort of die out. Circumstances, unless they're met with ideas, are just going to die out. But when ideas and circumstances meet, then boom, you know, you get this huge change. And so there's plenty of time where people have ideas, but they just, you know, they're not going to go anywhere. And there's also moments where there's like, we're in a revolutionary moment, but there's no ideas. And so it has to be like the way Friedman and Rose Friedman, you know, put in Free to Choose. Whereas what you do is you put the ideas on the shelf so that when the revolutionary moment happens, you can pull them down and use them. And, you know, that's why Friedman thought it was valuable to fight the feudal crusade, right? So, you know, be able to work on these ideas. And I think it's very valuable for us to think about what went wrong in the lessons from 1989, 1992 onward,
yeah,
and what went right, and try to figure out, like, hey, you know, what is the better way to advance a true radical liberalism of democratic self-governance that's able to generate for its population peace and prosperity? And, you know, because the world is conflict prone, right? And all of this. And so how is it that we continue to strive for peace and prosperity in a conflict prone world? What are the institutions that are necessary? We can't just pick up the phone and say institutions,
right?
We have to talk about something a lot more, like the particulars and how they fit and what, how they interact with culture and what are the right attitudes that, you know, might call sensibilities that the population has to have.
Right.
Yeah.
So on that note of kind of what went right, what went wrong, what kind of particular institutions might be important, what are some of these kind of generalizable lessons we can pull away from Estonia?
Well, again, I think that the way that we present it in the in this monograph, and it's not, it's not cherry picking to fit with Fraser's Economic Freedom Index, but it is the case that on the measures of the Economic Freedom Index, if you look at Estonia, what they did was relative to their control group, they did what the Economic Freedom Index asked you to do,
mm-hmm.
right? And so they basically shored up their property rights system. They have fiscal discipline. They had a flat tax, but then they had a VAT tax as well. Now that's standard European policy, oh, yeah. but that's part of how they got social spending and that kind of stuff. You know, their open trade, competitive, so their competitiveness in their economy was not just their own market, but their international market. So the standard idea that, you know, the division of labor is limited by the extent of the market. You grow the extent of the market, you're going to have more refinements in division of labor. So you have more productive specialization and peaceful social cooperation. And so, you know, the Estonian system basically follows, you know, that path. And they did that, like, right out of the gate and continue to do it. And it didn't, you know, now, again, as I said, you know, they, like all European countries, are generous on their social welfare state and right. things like that, but you know, at the same time, they have an amazingly open economy. I mean, they got rid of tariffs, right? I mean,
right.
you know, so like, who does that, right? They did that, right? So this
not
is
not the U.S. That's
yeah.
For
so
sure.
this is a different. So this is a different kind of beast, you know. Now it is true that in the United States, one of the questions that you so this goes back to our details mattering. You know, we're an economy with 330 million people, right? That's over, you know, how many time zones, right? And so it's this huge, you know, and we don't have internal, like, you know, as strong an internal restriction. So we have this domestic market, which is bigger than most people's international market.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can probably screw up our international trade more than other countries could.
Right.
Or a smaller country can't screw up the international trade because that's where everything comes from. But even us, what did we learn in COVID with supply chains and everything like that? I had my house, you know, burned down during the middle of COVID. And I had to, you know, get furniture. And as you might know, furniture now comes from Vietnam. That's where they, you know, build furniture. And I had to wait forever for my dining room set because, you know, the chairs were stuck in some boat off of L.A. or something like that. It wasn't allowed in. And you know, I had all kinds of conspiracy theories from that. You know, with the, but you know, why the furniture company wasn't delivering my furniture, but you know, supply chains matter, right? Supply chains matter, and so even in an economy that's so domestically, you know, free, it still matters that our international borders. But imagine a country that's tiny; it really needs the, you know, the international world to open up, and so that's, you know, that's an important aspect of all of this. But yeah, no, I mean, if you just go down the list, right, just, you know, get a list of the of the Washington Consensus or get a list of vegan our freedom thing, and you go down and say, well, did they do this, this, and this? And that's how you end up being 12th in the world.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, 12th in the world is really the vast majority of the world is less free than Estonia is today. And that's pretty amazing considering where they were at.
Yeah. Look at where they came from.
Right.
And again, you know, the idea that they were subjected and subjugated by the Nazis and the communists.
Right.
This is a country that had a very ill fate. And not only that, go back earlier, they were subjugated by the Russian imperial power to begin with, right? And so you have the Tsarist imperialization, you have the Nazis occupation, you have the communist occupation, and yet still this is a country that breathes freedom. You know, what a lesson that is for the world. To understand that and grow from that, I think, and what are the mechanisms by which you can get that kind of world? And so I would love it if the entire world learned about the singing revolution and understood that by joining hands and singing songs in resistance to your oppressors. And so, you know, one of the things I said earlier about the ripping the Band-Aid. So I don't think it's about ripping the Band-Aid. I actually think it's about getting a boot off of your neck. So what's gone on is, you know, Orwell said that the, you know, future of humanity was a giant boot stepping on the face of humanity. Mm-hmm. And I've always liked to tell people, it doesn't matter whether or not that boot's on the left foot or the right foot. As long as it's stamping on your face, it's a terrible thing. And if you go to the very end of Thomas Sowell's Knowledge and Decisions, what he says is that freedom is not necessarily just the right for you to be able to speak and things like that. It's for ordinary people to have the elbow room to engage in ordinary activity that they don't have to seek the approval of their, you know, overlords. All right. And so I like to think that the lesson that we learn from a country like Estonia is that ordinary people can do extraordinary things if just given the freedom. Whereas a lot of stories about successful transitions are extraordinary individuals, if given the right power, can do extraordinary things. Mm-hmm. No. The strength of what Mart Lahr and his colleagues did was they opened up that space, not for them to be the powerful overlord, but instead for them to step back and be restrained and turn the power over to the people so that they could do it. And that's why you're, you know, the Norberg, you know, piece on Estonia or whatever, because it's ordinary people that are doing extraordinary things if just given the freedom to do it. And so if we give people the freedom of choice and get out of their way, get the boot off of their neck, get the boot off stamping on their face, then you see freedom opening up. And you see all these other things going on. And the consequences of that are longer, more prosperous, and happier lives.
I think that's a beautiful message. Before we wrap up, I'm going to mention one thing. So you mentioned the Norberg piece. So just for listeners, Johan Norberg, a few years back, did a video for the Free to Choose Network. And it was called Economic Freedom in Action, Changing Lives. And Estonia was one of several case studies that he explores in that video. And I highly recommend it for those who are interested in, you know, the importance of economic freedom and how it impacts, as you said, the average person. But I also wanted to ask you, is there anything about Estonia's experience that we didn't get a chance to touch on? Because I want to make sure that, you know, it's such a good story. I want to make sure that we get all of the things that you wanted to talk about out there for listeners.
So I think that one of the things that Matt and Constantine and I did in this monograph is that more than in the Poland monograph, in both cases, we did this, but in this one a little bit more, as we delved a lot more into the consequences of Soviet occupation and the the dark shadow of that on a people. And so I think if you understand just the depths of the totalitarian nightmare. So in another organization, I run a reading group for them, Liberty Fund. It's called No Due Date. Your listeners should all join it. We'll be having
some. I should join it. I've been
2024. This month, we're reading Darkness at Noon by Arthur Kessler, which is one of the great, sort of dystopian stories about the totalitarian mindset. And this is focuses on the show trials in the 30s in Stalin's Russia. If you understand, like, the complete victory of the totalitarian mindset on the Soviet society. So it's like, you know, what Hannah Arendt warned us about in terms of suppressing civil society, of isolating individuals, of all these things like that. And then to see the Estonians, the resiliency and the, gumption of these people to grab hold of freedom with both hands. I think that is an inspiring message to all of us about how it is that even in the depths of such a overwhelming oppression, that individuals can find within themselves the ability to lift themselves up and exalt themselves against the subjugation of the violence of the state. And it's an amazing, inspiring story. I think all of these countries that have escaped the yoke of socialism are, in fact, very inspiring. And I hope young people embrace them for the romantic liberalism that they reflect, as opposed to thinking of liberalism as just the status quo. And none of this stuff in here is just a defense of the status quo. It is a exalting of the power of liberty to lift people and improve their lives and by giving them more liberty, more autonomy, more freedom, and
and letting them discover who they want to be.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, are there any book recommendations? I know you've mentioned throughout our conversation several pieces that listeners might want to look out for, but are there any other books or videos, blogs, anything you would recommend to listeners who really want to get a sense of what it's like to live under the reality of socialism?
Well, I mentioned Darkness at Noon. It's a great novel. I also would recommend Orlando Figes's book, Whisperers, which is about what it's like to live in these kind of societies in which, you know, and of course, there's a classic, Hannah Arendt's Origin of Totalitarianism is a classic. But I would be remiss if I didn't also mention my teacher, Don LaVoy. I think Don LaVoy's book, Rivalry and Central Planning, is the best book to talk about the debate that took place over socialist calculation in the 20th century. And then his book, National Economic Planning, What is Left, really tells us about the betrayal of the ideals of the left because of planning and why planning leads to the militarization of the economy, which undermines the very values that the left had in mind, and why a true radical liberalism is the actual heir apparent to the values of the left. And I hope that young people actually look into that and pursue and think about that. And if they're going to do that, then after reading LaVoy, Deirdre McCloskey's most recent books, How Liberalism Works, for example, would be a really great, read for them to understand the power of that. And then I also have a book called The Struggle for a Better World. And if anyone that your listeners email me, I will send them a PDF version of the book so that they can read it if they would like. So
all of the books that you mentioned are phenomenal, and I couldn't help but think about LaVoy, especially throughout the earlier part of our conversation, because it's so important to highlight that even smaller scale planning. It doesn't need to be this entire economy-wide planning. Yeah. Even that smaller scale planning is going to be plagued with this power problem, and a lot of the problems that you've talked about.
Yeah, Roy calls them a knowledge problem and a power problem. What we do in our books is we and it starts all the way back in our Matt and I wrote a book called Applied Mainline Economics.
Right.
We break it down into a control problem. We have to control your population. That would be Adam Smith's man of systems in the chessboard. They got to control and manipulate the chessboard, right? But then we also have a knowledge problem, which is whether or not the statesman, this again is Adam Smith, whether or not the statesman is in a position to judge better than others how to use and allocate their capital. Smith argues, no, they don't. And so you have a control problem, you have a knowledge problem, but then you also have an incentive problem, right? Which is, how is it that you're going to align the incentives to make sure that you produce the output that you want to do? And that's why there's so much in both of our monographs, we focus on collective farming versus private plots. And show that because it's the most easy example to show is like what happens when you had the private plots with inside of the collective farms, and all of a sudden the private plots are much smaller but producing more than the other ones are producing. Well, that's the incentive issues that are involved in individuals and the way that you take care of resources and husband them and all this stuff like that. That's all, part of it. So you have a control problem, a knowledge problem, and an incentive problem, and they interact. And so that's what we tried to do to give more, meat to what Lavoie was doing. But Lavoie's knowledge problem and power problem are all the same thing. They're all connected up.
And definitely important.
The knowledge problem generates the power problem. And I think that's a really key issue.
Yeah. Yeah. In the absence of knowledge problems, we wouldn't necessarily have those incentive problems. But when you don't have the price mechanism and you're making decisions about how to allocate resources through a central planning process, then that begets all of these other additional problems.
We don't quite say it this way in the book, but I've said it in lots of different things that I've written, is that you have property, prices, and profit loss. Property gives us incentives, prices gives us information, profit and loss accounting by luring, profits lure us, losses discipline us, that gives us innovation. So we get incentives, information, and innovation from property, prices, and profit loss. If I get rid of property, prices, and profit loss, I still, for my economic system, and need incentives, information, and innovation. But the question is, where does it come from? I've taken away the very thing that gives it to me. So when I substitute in planning, what I'm going to do is I'm not going to answer those questions about economic incentives, economic information, and economic innovation. I'm going to do politics because the coin of the realm then is political. So I'm going to arrange resources to reward my political friends, not to yield greatest more for, get more for less. I'm going to actually try to get more for less in politics. So I want to have a minimum winning coalition, right? To be able to defeat my enemy, right? So in a world of, two wolves and one lamb, the two wolves get together and make sure the lamb is dinner, right? And so this is about the incentive alignments that are involved. And so we substitute political decision-making for economic decision-making. We're still making decisions, right? And so then when we do that, then we get all the power plays and all stuff like that. So yes. Lavoie was brilliant. It's a very, very valuable two books. And I hope readers, they're available inexpensively through Mercatus. And I hope, listeners here, take advantage of that, because I think they are very, very important books for our time.
I definitely agree. Well, thank you so much, Pete, for sharing your time and your vast knowledge of socialist economies with me and with listeners. I have learned a lot from you about Estonia's experiment with socialism and their return to markets. And this was a wonderful story full of hope and a real testament to the role that markets play in unleashing human creativity and human flourishing. So I hope listeners have found this conversation informative as well. Thank you so much, Pete.
Thank you, Rosie. I'm thrilled to be here with you and this project, and I'm very excited to listen to all of your podcasts.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us for the Realities of Socialism podcast, where we take a deep dive into the consequences of socialism as it was imposed on tens of millions of people during the 20th century. For more information, including infographics, free books, and more podcast episodes, visit realitiesofsocialism.org.